and to enjoy this summer social. Thank all those who have a part in creating that. Very good. I'm also so very glad and privileged to be with you in this place of very fond memories and to see so many familiar and so many new faces. That the Jefferson Center is thriving and promoting its mission to the people of this city and the region is compelling evidence of the good work and enthusiasm that's been displayed since the founding board initiated this organization with its compelling programs. I never once doubted that the center would continue to thrive and grow, and the evidence is certainly apparent. It truly, truly warms my heart. Thank you all for continuing the vision that the founding members had 12 very long years ago. I would guess that most of you are familiar with product promotional ads on television. Especially those with a kind of frenzied approach, and just when you think the ad is finished, there appears in bold colored letters and voiceover, "But wait, there's more." I chose that somewhat campy title for this talk because I want to continue your participation and support for the Jefferson Center and to see that this community has a bright future. And that I share this with you by my continued involvement and my continued support. To do its work and to fulfill its mission, this family, this organization needs your sustaining support and involvement, your time, your talent, and your treasure. This sounds like a stewardship pitch from a church priest, but I did do that once upon a time. There is more. And the more is the future of the Jefferson Center. Some of you here may remember that I am a perennial reader. Books, as Thomas Jefferson said, are something I cannot live without. He wrote this in a letter to his dear friend John Adams in 1815. Harvey and I seem to keep Amazon.com's book section in business. He with his Kindle and I with my hardcovers and paperbacks. And every day, it seems, the postman or UPS man or woman rings our doorbell with a book or books package. At least there they ring the bell to let you know it's there. So that's why I want to reflect with you tonight about the latest books that have interested me and perhaps encourage you, I hope, to read some of them or have the center's book groups possibly choose one or more of them for their study and discussion. But it should be the same for you individually. There was a handout that is available to you. If you did not get a copy, I think you can ask Roy for one or Victoria, who have that handout with details on all the books that I'm mentioning today, so you might get a copy if you decide to do that. Hopefully, and I know I can remember Karen Chapman standing by my ear saying, tell them to go to Bloomsbury Books, not to that online service. Speaking of Thomas Jefferson, recently I had the much belated pleasure to read the complete John Adams and Thomas Jefferson letters, all their correspondence, covering the years 1777 to 1826. Truly an amazing collection of over 600 pages.
That's all.
What was of specific interest to me was Adams and particularly Jefferson's confidential thoughts on religion, especially Christianity. Now let us remember that even the most recent of those letters were written 190 years ago, and the earliest of them 239 years ago. That time distance gives their thoughts an even greater interest to this retired professor of history and religion, but it should be the same for you as well. It's important for us to keep in mind Jefferson's thoughts on religion. They were not particularly the thoughts of many people today, because he was a deist, and there are few deists around now. His personal principles were distasteful to many Christians then, as they are to many now, particularly evangelical Christians. He was a thoroughgoing skeptic who valued reason much more than faith and subjected every religious tradition, including his own, to great scientific scrutiny as he knew it. He was and is most disliked, first, with regard to religion, for his writing the Virginia Statutes for Religious Freedom, a radical and groundbreaking document that would come to serve as the model for the legal principle of church-state separation. Religious freedom was sacred to Jefferson, and it was not the wingnut concept of some religious freedom, in quotes, espoused by fundamentalist Christian legislators in places like North Carolina, Mississippi, Georgia, and Tennessee these days, which is nothing but, as you all probably understand, a smokescreen for intolerance and bigotry. Second, Jefferson was and is scorned by many for this advocacy, his advocacy of French science and philosophy that was so widely perceived during his lifetime as atheistic. Third, he is championed as the author of Notes on the State of Virginia, a classic of 18th century free thought. This 1784 document created an outrage among the religiously minded of his day, sometimes reaching hysterical levels. The most famous lines from his work at this time regarding this hysteria were, quote, "But it does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no God. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. Reason and free inquiry are the only effectual agents against error. They are the natural enemies of error and of error only." End quote. The deism that Jefferson embraced was a belief in what he called nature's God, in quotations. For him, a spirit that lay behind the mechanisms that ran the universe, but a spirit that had little or very little interest in the affairs of humankind. Despite service on the vestry of his local Anglican parish church in Virginia with its, as I can well attest from my history, easygoing and undemanding religion, Jefferson cannot realistically be called a Christian in the true sense of the word. He had very little taste for what was termed revelation and even less use for priests, particularly Roman Catholic ones. Although, interestingly enough, it seems as if he used the term priest throughout his letters to refer to any minister or pastor. He did not believe in the divinity of Jesus of Nazareth, although he did champion Jesus' moral system. His major emphasis was always on religious freedom, and that included freedom from religion. For anyone today to believe that Jefferson's religious thought was otherwise, quite frankly, is simply uninformed, having clearly not read nor understood his voluminous written remarks on the subject. To flesh out my points, I want to quote some relevant passages on religion from his writings to John Adams, another deist founder of our country. Oh, you wouldn't believe the things I read constantly in the press or wherever here on television about our great founding fathers, our Christian fathers, and blah, blah, blah. Well, it's just nonsense. They were all basically deists or non-believers of any kind. Jefferson's comments on religion in letters to Adams begin in 1812 and last to 1826, the year both he and Adams died on the very same day, July the 4th, if you believe it. Adams was of Puritan heritage.
It must be good to arrange that.
Summing up his religion as the Hebrew Ten Commandments and Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Jefferson and Adams were both advocates of freedom of the mind and would not minimize the tyranny of spirituality that still threatened in their day. Both of them sincerely thought that the world was good as a whole. Jefferson said, "I steer my bark with hope in the head, leaving fear astern." In 1817, writing to Adams, Jefferson says of those who claimed his religion had changed, which some did, quote, "Now this supposed that they knew what had been my religion before, taking for it the word of their priests, whom I certainly never made the confidence of my creed. My answer was to, quote, say nothing of my religion. It was known to my God, little g, and myself alone. Its evidence before the world is to be sought in my life. It that has been honest and dutiful to society, the religion which has regulated it cannot be a bad one." Unquote. Jefferson's skepticism about human speculation beyond the realm of the tangible was a major part of his belief. Both he and Adams primarily wrote about religion during these last years, as I mentioned, of their lives. Jefferson was truly a true believer, as philosophers of the 18th century Enlightenment were concerned. He followed in the footsteps of John Locke and others at the time. He wrote to Adams about his creed of materialism. He also claimed that the Christian church held a heresy of immaterialism, as he called it, a position of which he claimed Jesus said absolutely nothing. Quote, "He," meaning Jesus, "told us indeed that God is a spirit, but he has not defined what a spirit is or not. Nor has he said, is it not matter? And the ancient fathers generally, if not universally, held it to be matter, light and thick indeed, an ethereal gas, but still a matter." He concluded, quote, "I am satisfied and sufficiently occupied with the things which are, without tormenting or troubling myself about all those things which may indeed be, but of which I have no evidence." For Jefferson, evidence, and this is a key word in what I have to say to you today, really, for Jefferson and all of these others, evidence was key to belief and his philosophy of life and his understanding of the deist universe. Thank you. The most he would presume to offer with regard to his religious views was the belief in the creator, small c, and benevolent governor of the world. Alas, to those past and present fundamentalist Christians who claim that the United States was founded on the same Christian principles that their evangelical Protestant faith tells them was held by strong Christian men like Adams and our beloved Thomas Jefferson, as I mentioned before, the answer is sorry, it ain't so. And I'm sure you will agree that we have heard truckloads of this kind of, I said crap, but I'll say talk instead, talk, especially during the 2016 political campaign season, broke the light of day far too many months ago. It is to this matter of evidence, again, that I wish to return, and something that was so much the basis for Jefferson's reasoning And quite frankly, the reason I came to the conclusion that this organization should be named after him. Without a doubt, for me anyway, the most fascinating and compelling book that I have read in the last 6 months has been Richard Carrier's On the Historicity of Jesus, Why We Might Have Reason for Doubt. Now, I understand that you've had Dr. Carrier here to speak with you some years back. I was not here, nor did I have the privilege of hearing Richard in any of his talks, but I have certainly, I can attest, plowed through this book very well. He was a Thomas Jefferson Memorial Lecturer here 4 years ago, and in 2008 earned his PhD in Ancient History from Columbia University. He has now published this magnum opus about Jesus of Nazareth that is a peer-reviewed book published by a recognized academic publisher in the United Kingdom, a no mean feat. And as a scholar and as a former professor, I can tell you, if you do not publish through a peer-reviewed academic publisher, you're generally not considered very high on the totem pole, in fact, pretty low. And I can attest that I've been trying to get to that point for some years. But arcane topics like Hawaiian political and religious history don't quite make it, I guess. Carrier has now published this remarkable book, a book that has seriously disturbed many Christian apologists who are having a difficult time dealing with his conclusions. It is a long book. It is very scholarly, with the most detailed and precise references and explanations that I have ever seen in such works, and I've read countless numbers of them. It comprises 618 pages of text, plus an extensive bibliography. I will spare you except the nuts and bolts, and then you can decide if you wish to wade through this fascinating and compelling work, and I hope you will, frankly. This is actually the second of two volumes examining, quote, a daring question, a case to be made that Jesus never really existed as a historical person. The alternative is that the Jesus we know originated as a mythical character, in tales symbolically narrating the salvific acts of a divine being who never walked the earth and probably never existed at all, end quote. Dr. Carrier's notes that the point of his book is, quote, not to end the debate, but to demonstrate the scholars need to take this hypothesis more seriously before simply dismissing it out of hand, and that they need much better arguments against it than they've heretofore deployed. A better refutation is needed, and a better theory of historicity, which actually credibly explains all the oddities in the evidence. Just a brief word on his first book. It was called Proving History. It basically develops a formal historical method for approaching historical investigation or any historical debate, which will produce, quote, an objectively credible a conclusion as any honest historian can reach. I, as one trained as a professional historian, can only applaud such an approach, and I found his established historical method to be quite reasonable. I wish only to mention some of the issues related to the Jesus problem, as he calls it, and then mention a little about his research and then a note about his conclusions. First of all, there are those today who maintain there was a real Jesus of Nazareth, some relevant sort, which Carrier calls historicists. And there are those also who argue that this Jesus, on the other hand, was mythical. These people he calls mythicists. At the very least, most contemporary scholars of any standing in academia today agree some elements of the things said about this man, Jesus of Nazareth, aren't historically true, and many even conclude most are not. For example, the Westar Institute, which some of you may know of, home of the famous, some think infamous, Jesus Seminar, representatives of which were part of the first summer institute of the Jefferson Center here in 2005, take a skeptical approach to much of the gospel sayings of Jesus. However, there is today among scholars little agreement as to what is historical and what is not. There are also countless Jesus myth theories, many, some of which some of you also may remember from Acharya S., who once lived here in Ashland and spoke to several salons during my time with you. Unfortunately, this very bright and very delightful young lady died last December, at a fairly young age. A big shock. Carrier takes the approach that the original story about Jesus was mythic, and that this myth, and he makes it very clear what he means by this four-letter word, myth, which is probably one of the most misunderstood words in the English language, at least it has been for students of mine. Myth is simply a technical word used by linguists, English professors, and other academics, literature scholars, and so forth, to mean story. Essentially, could you shut the door, please? I've heard enough. Essentially, that is to say, the more powerfully a story affects a people emotionally and morally, the more it is to be believed to be real. Eventually, the truth of what the story symbolized was confused with the truth of the story itself. Carrier then cites the King Arthur legend as a good example of this. His book begins the debate, or at least he hopes it will, on a highly skilled professional and scholarly basis as to the historicity of Jesus. And he takes considerable space explaining the hypothesis of historicity. How can we know if something is historically true, that it happened? He is very detailed and devotes much time explaining his approach and conclusions. He makes several basic statements like, we have absolutely zero archaeological corroboration for the existence of Jesus. Those who promote the view that he existed defend theories, quote, for which not enough evidence survives to really know, end quote. And this exposes a serious, quote, methodological problem, end quote. There follows a chapter on the hypothesis of myth, which Carrier details on the evidence that the Jesus story was mythic and not historical. In other words, it was basically, as I said a few minutes earlier about myth, a story. Yeah. In this chapter, he lays out his minimal Jesus myth theory, distilled down for you to the most basic principles as follows. One, at the origin of Christianity, Jesus was thought to be a celestial deity, much like any other. Two, like many other celestial deities, this Jesus communicated with his subjects only through dreams, visions, and other forms of divine inspiration, such as prophecy, both past and present. Three, like some other celestial deities, this Jesus was originally believed to have endured an ordeal of incarnation, death, burial, and resurrection in a supernatural realm. Four, as for the many other celestial deities, of which there are countless numbers, an allegorical story of this same Jesus was then composed and told within the sacred community of Jews, which placed him on earth in history as a divine man with an earthly family, companions, enemies, friends, complete with deeds and sayings, and an earthly depiction of his ordeal. 5. Subsequent communities of worshipers believed, or at least taught, that this invented sacred story was real, and either not allegorical or only additionally allegorical. I'm going to skip over to a point that I think is important to make, that to grab your attention right here. One amusing section of this book describes heroes who never existed. And Carrier cites a number of popular ones, of course, that you all know, such as Betty Crocker, Aunt Jemima, Ronald McDonald, Uncle Ben, and others, none of which has any evidence for their historical nature. The same goes for most ancient gods and goddesses and folk heroes that roamed the world. Evidence, again, is his point. Evidence is what is key, what is crucial. All decisions about the past should be based on evidence. The proof of any historicity of Jesus lies solely in the lap of those who are Christian apologists and need to confront the realities that Carrier has so, I think, eloquently displayed in his book. He ends this incredible tome with the statement, "I intend this book not to end, but to begin a debate about this regarding both its methods and its conclusions. I know many devout Christian scholars will balk and claim to find all matter of bogus or irrelevant or insignificant holes or flaws in my arguments, but they would do that anyway. Witness what many Christian scholars come up with just to reject evolution or to defend the literal miraculous resurrection of Jesus, which they claim they can do even with very paltry evidence, only depicted in writings of the early Christian community. Consequently," he ends, "I don't care anymore what Christian apologists think. They are not rational people. I only want to know what rational scholars think." And I must say I agree with that. Many of you know that in addition, and I was asked a couple of questions about this on my way in and while I was getting food and so forth. Many of you know that in addition to being a professional historian in my life, I also had a career as an Episcopal priest. I tell people I was bivocational. And in San Francisco, that always got a giggle. Although I am no longer, please listen carefully, although I am no longer connected to the church, I did dip my toe into it once or twice since I left Ashland, will confess. Mostly because I missed the organ music and the ceremony. I have not believed in the church's teachings for many years. Some of you remember, perhaps, when I, quote, came out as a non-believer. Mm-hmm. On the front page of the Ashland Daily Tidings. Wow. In 2008, which sent a shockwave through Trinity Church on 2nd Street. The rector emailed me and said, "Well, I presume you'll be sending in your renunciation of the ministry to the bishop this week." I didn't, nor did I respond to her. But this leads into the next book on which I wish to comment. Daniel Dennett, the great philosopher, and Linda LaScola, a wonderful woman I got to know, their book, Caught in the Pulpit, Leaving Belief Behind. This is a fascinating book, with a foreword by probably one of the most brilliant scientists living today, Richard Dawkins. Harvey and I had the great pleasure of meeting in Los Angeles at a Center for Inquiry conference some years back. This is an absolutely fascinating book with a foreword by Dawkins that explores what it's like to be a minister or a rabbi who no longer believes in God or that Jesus Christ was a historical person. In this updated and expanded edition of their groundbreaking study, the famous philosopher of Tufts University, Bennett, and his researcher, co-author, LaScola, expose a bunch of clergy who no longer believe what they publicly preach, or didn't, like me. The book is based on confidential interviews of clergy from across the spectrum, from liberal to literalists, and reveals how their lives of service to their church or synagogue has led them to a position at odds with their professed beliefs and profession. Allow me a personal comment here. Around 2006 or 7, while living here in Ashland and heading up this illustrious center, I was in touch with Linda LaScola, who somehow or other got my telephone number and called me up. She was just beginning her research into disbelieving clergy from her headquarters in Washington, D.C. We had a bunch of chats over a year, maybe longer than a year, and she quizzed me on my beliefs or lack of them, and how, Bob, how can you still claim to be an Episcopal priest? And I said to her some of the same reflections that I offered from my personal journey are found in this book, being offered by other people. Many of them struggled with their beliefs and abandoned them, while others still suffer in tender and lonely silence while maintaining their professional life. Thankfully, that was not my case, the latter. This book carefully and sensitively reveals a common journey that often had far-reaching implications, not just for the individual clergy, but for families, for congregations, for communities, but also for the future of organized religion, particularly here in the United States, and I will speak more on that topic shortly. Dennett and LaScola refer to, quote, the inflated respect and deference, end quote, that the position of a cleric commands and the limelight in which they exercise their considerable talents as preachers. I'm just going to put this in because it came to mind and I can't not say it. When I was in high school, long before written language replaced sign language, anyway, when I was in high school, I was a member of the Presbyterian Church because that's where my parents took me. And there was a young youth minister there who was quite critical of me for whatever reason. I never figured it out. But I played the organ on Sunday nights for their worship service. And I remember he said, the only reason you're doing that, the only reason you want to be a minister, I was telling people then that I wanted to be a Presbyterian minister. The only reason you want to be a minister is that you want to be in the spotlight. And you know, I never really forgot that, and in many occasions, and Harvey can testify to that, there were many occasions in my life where being in the spotlight, sitting up in front of 200 people with Senator John Danforth and talking about his latest book, was pretty important to me. And it was important insofar as that it made me feel like I had something to offer. Particularly growing up as a gay man, okay? So those two things go together, and that's sort of a personal testimony. I can relate to what Linda LaScola and Diane Dennett say. I can relate to that for most of you who would wish to learn about an often overlooked segment of this population, and believe me, I know many who fit this category, who are still in the pulpit, still employed by the church, even the Episcopal Church, which is very, very progressive and liberal. But they're still there, and they don't believe a thing, but they are scared to say one thing about it, even
progressive and liberal.
Many of them, to their wives and families. This profession and members of it once were elevated to a very high pedestal. Not so much anymore. And I remember wondering what had happened. Ministers used to get all kinds of deference. Brooks Brothers, you got a card without having to, what was it? In New York, you got a credit card because we were clergy.
And a discount.
And a thank you. 10% discount. Clergy got a discount. So without religion in one's life, as is the case with me and probably most of you, is there any room for what is termed spirituality without religion? Sam Harris, one of the illustrious new atheists, the author of best-selling books, The End of Faith, Letter to a Christian Nation, The Moral Landscape, Free Will, and Lying, and co-founder and CEO of Project Reason, now with a PhD himself in neuroscience, no mean feat, from UCLA, has written a short book called Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. And I know there are people here, and I won't name them, but I remember them telling me they were not religious, but they were spiritual. They're here, some of you. So this is a book for you. The End of Faith. Not The End of Faith. Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. I read this book with interest and with hope that somehow or other it would speak to me, but I came away a little disappointed because it wasn't exactly what I had in mind. But perhaps you would not feel the same way as I did. Harris offers really a middle path between Christianity on one hand and Asian religion on the other, such as Buddhism, while exploring the scientific underpinnings of spirituality. He argues that there is more to understanding reality than secular culture and science generally allow. And there were a few points that really struck me and made me think. First of all, regarding what he terms mindfulness, Harris says, it is always now. That might sound to you trite, but it is the truth. It is not quite true as a matter of neurology, because our minds are built upon layers of inputs whose timing we know must be different, but it is true as a matter of conscious experience. The reality of your life is always now. It is not then, it is not the future, it is now. And it took someone like Harris to wake me up. And to realize this is liberating. In fact, there is nothing more important to understand if you want to be happy in this world, I think, as he says. But Harris adds that we may spend most of our lives, forgetting this truth. We overlook it, we flee from it, we repudiate it. And the very unfortunate thing is that we may succeed. We may manage to avoid being happy while struggling to become happy. Therefore, we spend our lives being far less content than we might otherwise be. We often fail to appreciate what we have until we have lost it. And Harris suggests a way through this dilemma by practicing a technique which comes from the oldest tradition of Buddhism. I will let you discover how Harris demonstrates how to meditate and how to become spiritual without religion, and if and when you read this book, you will find that out. But wait, there's more. A little bit. Philip Kitcher is the John Dewey Professor of Philosophy at Columbia University. His work has received praise for its expanding the frontiers of science and philosophy, His book, Life After Faith, The Case for Secular Humanism, published 2 years ago by Yale University Press, is a major addition to the literature of secularism, secular humanism, and atheism. This book is not an easy, quick read. It is difficult. It has intricate and complex concepts and ideas with which to process and understand. But believe me, the points he makes in this book make it all the worthwhile for sticking with it. I have read it twice. Now, I don't read a lot of books twice, at least right after. You know, I'm reading now a P.D. James book that I read 15 years ago, but that's not like reading Kitcher 2 months later. Thank you.